Boston at the Park Plaza Hotel, which is the headquarters of the 33rd Annual Cognitive Science Conference, CogSci 2011. We're with Susan Golden Meadow, who's officially, let me just get this right, Beardsley Rummel Distinguished Service Professor of Psychology at the University of Chicago. And it also says here she is a pioneer and internationally renowned expert on the cognitive bases of gesture and sign language, which we knew. But bring me up to speed on your work at this point and what you've discovered being at this meeting that has given you any new thoughts, insights, directions.
Okay. Well, there are two pieces to the work.
Right.
Because there's the gesture piece and the sign language and quotes piece. Because the sign language that I study is not established sign language. It's the spontaneous sign systems that deaf children make up when they're not being exposed to sign language and they're too deaf to learn spoken language. So it's sort of sign language on the way to becoming sign, or a gesture on the way to becoming sign language, which is really how I think about it. Yeah. So that's one piece of the work that we're currently looking at. We've been looking at deaf children of hearing parents in a variety of cultures. We've looked at them in America, in Turkey, and in China. And we're currently looking at them in Nicaragua. And the interest in looking at them in Nicaragua is because we can look at these home signers, as they're called, the systems that they create on their own, essentially as individuals. But in Nicaragua, we have that very special situation where home signers 35 years ago came together to form a group and formed the first cohort of Nicaraguan Sign Language. And then that cohort has then morphed into cohort 2, which is morphing into cohort 3 and whatever. So we can begin to follow a language, the birth of a language, really. And home sign is the very first stage. So I'm working with Andy Sangus and Marie Coppola and a number of others to try to follow this language development.
Let me ask some sort of Idiot's Guide 101 questions. But so in all of these different countries, are there differences in the sign languages that are created?
It's a really good question.
What are the similarities?
Well, that's why we went to do it initially, because we were thinking, okay, you know, a deaf kid of hearing parents. And first of all, we started studying these deaf children of hearing parents in America.
Right.
And surprisingly to us, the children developed these gesture systems that looked a lot like each other, even though they didn't know one another. I mean, not just, you know, that they use this for eat, that's a no-brainer, but that they tended to put gestures for patients, for objects that are being acted upon, before the gestures for actions. And every single kid was doing the same thing, even though they didn't know each other. So then we started thinking, okay, maybe there's cultural pressure, unseen cultural pressure that's making these kids all be the same. So, great, let's go look in other cultures to see whether there are differences between American children inventing their own home signs and Chinese children and Turkish children. And we thought it could be different because the gesture is different in these different cultures. And what we've been finding is a lot of similarity. I mean, you know, you find some differences. So in China, when they talk about eat, they do this, but they also do this. You know, that's not a surprise. But this ordering of patients coming before acts and certain kinds of little baby syntax kinds of things have been the same. I'm surprised at that. I really am surprised at that. And so now we have to come up with an explanation for why that happens.
All right. Put that into the context of speech.
Okay.
And I'm thinking of Chomsky's talk yesterday and the Purple's response and so on, Lissa's comments.
Right.
What is language? I mean, because you're not talking about spoken language at all,
right? Right. Okay. So, let's start with the assumption that that sign languages are languages. Are you okay with that?
Yes.
Okay. So, then the interesting question is what these children are doing, and should we call it language?
Right.
And it's a really interesting question. And so, one of the ways that we've decided to sort of figure out whether it's language is by looking at what these children do and compare it to what hearing kids do when they're acquiring spoken language and deaf children when they're acquiring sign language, and just seeing whether there are similarities. Now, I don't think these children are ever going to be able to get to the final point and invent American Sign Language. That's why this Nicaraguan Sign Language study is interesting, because we can sort of see the value added. You start with little home sign, you bring these home signers, and it won't go to the full, to the final end. You bring those home signers together, and you see what's the value added of having a community, of being both a producer of the system and also receiving the system. Because what's so unique about these home signers is that They're deaf kids of hearing parents. They produce these gestures, but their hearing parents want them to speak. They want them to be oral. And when they gesture like you and me. They're hearing people. They're not gesturing in the same way as the signers. So they produce this little home sign stuff, and they get back co-speech gesture. So they really don't ever receive what they produce. But when you start getting into this first cohort, you're being both a producer and a receiver, and that may really change the nature of language. And that's the interesting question for us. What do you get when you become a community? And then the next question that Annie Senges has looked at is what happens when you then pass this system through baby learners, the next generation? And we're going to be able to look at that sort of question. So in a way, we're almost asking it empirically, you know, what are the changes that happen in this situation? I want to call home sign language. I do want to call home sign language. And I want to make a distinction between that and co-speech gesture, the gestures that hearing speakers produce when they talk. I don't want to call that. I want to call what they produce with their mouths language, and gesture as gesture. But it's not structured in the same way as language, as sign language. It's actually one of the most interesting things that when you look at what these hearing parents do and they're gesturing along with speech, their gestures look qualitatively different from the gestures that the home signing kids produce. There's something that changes that is language, I think, when these kids are producing. And a part of it is that it's sort of discrete things, it's componential, it's combinatorial, in a way that the gestures, look at my gestures, I mean, you know, they're understandable, but they're not structured in the same way as the gestures that these home signers produce and that sign language is.
The Governing Board Symposium yesterday?
Yes.
Was called The Biology of Language in the 21st Century. How does your work inform that whole notion of the origins of language? How do you think of this?
Okay. I don't know that the work has any bearing on the origins of language, the first, you know, the evolutionary question that Noam Chomsky referred to. But I do think it bears on sort of the innate equipment that children come to language with, because these are children who aren't getting much in the way of linguistic input, but they're getting, you know, they're raised in loving homes, they have perfectly good social lives, whatever, they have the accoutrements of being a child raised in a home, but they don't have codified linguistic input. So we can see what children will fashion out of the input that they do get and what that looks like. And what I find fascinating is that it has a lot of language-like properties. I mean, it really doesn't, it's not a full-blown language, but it has the rudiments of language. Already, a kid by himself in not great communicative circumstances will begin to use gestures that are taking on language-like properties. So I think to the extent that we have those kinds of primitive properties there, it suggests that there really is something that children are bringing to the situation that are, you could call innate, if you want to use the word innate. But it doesn't address the issue of domain specificity. That's the issue that Lissa took on. Because it may be that the skills that are allowing these children to develop these properties are skills that you find in other domains as well. It's just they're being brought to bear in this communicative situation, and out comes what looks a lot like language. You know, you put a chimpanzee in that situation and they don't do that. They really don't. We've raised chimpanzees in homes before, and they don't start using their hands in the way that the deaf children do. So there's something about us as humans. I mean, I think it's actually very compelling evidence that there's something about us as humans, that we can not only learn this stuff, we all know that, we can create the stuff of language with not a lot of linguistic input.
Another idiot's guide question, forgive me, but one assumes that way back in the Pleistocene, that gestures preceded.
That's what one assumes, and there are theories of that. It's hard to know, because...
What's the current take on that?
I think you can find lots of different opinions on that. There certainly is a group of people who believe that there was a gestural language, and then speech came to take over it. But currently, when we speak, there is no culture that we've found that doesn't use speech as well as gesture. gestures sort of a really resilient, robust part of language. They go hand in hand. So it's a funny sort of evolutionary theory that has hands doing the real work, then has speech come in to do the real work, and gesture then takes the side light. And maybe that's true, but that you'd have to have a theory like that, because now gesture is there to stay, and it's very much a part of language. I mean, so robust that one of the things we've done is we've looked at blind people, congenitally blind people, never seen anybody gesture, and they gesture all the time whenever they're talking. They gesture even when they're talking to blind people. So it's a very robust part of speech. And I think whatever evolutionary story we have has got to take that into account. And I'm not sure they all do or can explain that well.
So is there a consensus view then on whether the mind is massively modular or whether it's a general purpose computer or all these various theories that are floating around?
I think you
Or does it matter?
I don't know. I don't know if it matters. I mean, it matters a lot to some people. It's not the question that I've engaged in.
Right.
Because, I mean, in order for me to engage in that question, I need to know, I have to study more than language. You know, you've got to look at other domains, and I haven't done that. I mean, that what these deaf children may be doing may be absolutely just an outpouring of cognition. But what's sort of interesting to me with respect to that question is that they don't put every cognitive thing they know into their language. The kinds of things they encode in language, the ways in which they encode things in language, are very language-like. So some of the things that Telmi was saying this morning that don't get encoded in morphology or in closed class items, my deaf kids don't encode either. That's sort of interesting.
Hmm.
You know, that's interesting. Where does that constraint come from? One would have said it comes from history, it comes from passing the language down and down and down, but it's there right away in these kids. So we could say it's just cognition that they're doing, it's an outpouring of cognition, but it's at least selective cognition. It's cognition that's being selected. Now maybe it's being selected for the purposes of communication. It doesn't seem quite right, because they do more with their systems than they need to do to get their ideas across. These are kids. You know, if I pointed at a drink and I do a drinky gesture, it's not any easier to understand than if I do this and point at the drink. This is particularly when the drink's right there. Nonetheless, they impose an order on things. So I think it isn't just for the purposes of communicating something to you, for your understanding. There's something more compelling about what they're doing. There's something else. Maybe it's cognition. Who knows what it is that's driving them?
What drove you to go in this particular direction? I mean,
well, I was always interested in the question of what children bring to language learning, and it had been said that deaf children in oral schools, where they weren't learning sign language, would sign behind the teacher's back. And so that's really what Heidi Feldman and Lila Gleitman and I started this many years ago. We really wanted to address that question. That's where we came from. And it's just taken us many, many, many years to sort of figure out which properties these kids have in home sign. So then in the process, how I got into gesture is from the home sign stuff, because these are deaf kids who are born to hearing parents. Their input is co-speech gesture. So I needed to both study their input by looking at co-speech gesture, and I also, and they should be compared to hearing kids who are speaking and gesturing. So
right.
I had to look at the hearing kids' gestures and the hearing adults' gestures, and that's how the other half of my life developed, looking at the gestures that go along with speech and what that tells us about learning and thinking. So I have a whole additional life looking at that kind of question.
But go back even further. Why did you even end up doing psychology, science? I mean, was it something at school, a teacher, a book?
I went to
parents?
Geneva. I went to Geneva for my junior year abroad. Not because I was so motivated. I was doing psychology, but it wasn't the real motivation. I wanted to go abroad, and I wanted to go to a place where I could speak the language, and I spoke French. And I studied at the Piagetian Institute.
Ah.
So I got really into psychology, looking at studying with Piaget and Inhelder and Sinclair, who was his language person at the time. And I also met Annette Comerleff Smith there. She was a student at the time.
Right.
So that really got me excited about this. And I came back and I did a senior honors thesis continuing my work that I'd done in Geneva, and then I applied to graduate school. So I really got hooked into it from going to Geneva. and seeing science in action and just watching Piaget think, which is amazing. You know, he was an amazing observer of children.
So how would you say his theories have held up over time?
Piaget's theories? Mm. Well, you know what's interesting about Piaget is that he wasn't so good at language. He's really, you know, very good at thinking about other things, but he didn't really like thinking about language and didn't sort of see it as anything other than another symbolic system. So I don't think that has held up particularly well at all. But, you know, and one of the funny things about this is I ended up using one of his tasks, the Piagetian conservation tasks, as my one of the main paradigms we've used to study gesture. So I've been looking at how we can teach children to learn conservation and sort of trying to figure out when children are ready to learn conservation. And I think you can tell that from the gestures that they produce. So they're not anti-Piagetian results. They fit within his theory.
Explain conservation.
Oh, conservation. Okay, so conservation is conservation of matter. For example, if I take two rows of checkers and I say to the child, does this row have the same number of checkers as this row? And the kid says yes. Okay, cool. Then I spread this row out. So this row is longer than this row. And I say to the kid, do they still have the same row of checkers, number of checkers? And non-conservatives will say, no, it's different. You know? And they might say, it's different because you moved them. Mm. And that's a non-conservative. But what we've found is, you know, kids who say, it's different because you moved them, that's one way of doing it. Another kid will say, it's different because you moved them. So he's talking about moving. But in his hands, he's actually conveying the one-to-one correspondence between the number of checkers in this row and the number of checkers in that row. He's still saying they're different. It's different. Different because you moved them. But in fact, in his gestures, he's giving a glimmer of an idea about the conservation idea that he'll eventually get. And we find that when we instruct children, the children who say it's different because you moved them or it's different because you moved them learn differently. And it's these guys, the mismatchers, who end up learning more quickly and learning more than the children whose gestures match their speech.
I've been talking a lot recently, and this is part of an enterprise I'm working on with Terry Sanofsky and Paula mm-hmm. Talal, trying to come up with some sort of X Prize for education and so on. And so we think a lot about how do you build better learners rather
yes.
than complain about bad teachers
okay.
and all the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of building better learners, I mean, all what you're working with is 3 pounds of wonder tissue on the end of every kid's spinal
uh-huh.
column. So,
right.
But to improve that, to figure out how to, you know, encourage the neural correlates of engagement, as Clancy Blair would put it, and so on. Does any of this work
get at that
into the schools?
Okay, I'm trying. I'm working on it. Okay, so with these gestures, we've been looking at gesture and its role in thinking and learning. So what I just explained is sort of a way in which gesture can tell you that one child is ready to learn or not. Right. So a kid who produces these mismatchy gestures is ready to learn. If teachers were to pay attention to that, they could actually know more about what. Because if you listen to both children, they're saying, it's different because you move them. They sound exactly the same. But if you watch them, one knows something more than the other one. So one way in which we're trying to get into the schools and talk to teachers is to tell them to pay attention to these nonverbal gestures that children produce. I think good teachers do it anyhow, yeah. But not all teachers are good teachers. Okay, so that's one way. The other way I think it can get into the schools is if we have been playing with encouraging kids to gesture, making them gesture, and when we make them gesture, new ideas come out of their hands that they're not saying with their mouths. They're saying things with their hands. And again, that helps them learn. They're better learners. So we force kids to gesture on this math problem we do. We just say, next time you do the problem, gesture. Out comes different ideas. And then when we instruct them, they learn more. So I think forcing kids to gesture may be another way, not forcing is too hard a word, encouraging children to gesture may be another way in which we can encourage learning, because we're finding that gesturing is good for learning.
You wrote a book on that, didn't you? I'm just hearing gesture, the gestures
yes.
we produce in the tour.
And
then the new one, the more recent one, is The Resilience of Language.
So The Resilience of Language is on the Deaf Children's Home Sign,
right.
And the Hearing Gesture is on the co-speech gestures that we produce. But I'm getting more into the education aspects now.
Yeah. So, your own trajectory there, the Geneva thing and so on and so forth, you learn stuff as you're going along on these ways, and you have probably advice from mentors and so on and so forth. And you have students now. So, what, having been through this, what is your advice to a young scientist at this point?
Advice to a young scientist, be interested in what you're doing. I mean, just get excited, you know, and really follow. For me, data matters a lot. I mean, having a good question is an important thing, but then listening to the data and letting it speak to you and tell you where to go next. You know, just being, I think maybe some of that is from Piaget, being a good observer, watching, looking, and being informed by what you do. But I think being excited about what you do is really important. And I would encourage people to, you know, go with their passions.
Yeah. Do you think much about the role of science in society? I've been asking people a lot about this because the when he came into office, President Obama said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place.
Yeah.
And one wonders what that is.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's important that we do science. I actually think it's important that we educate people to be able to evaluate data, which we're not doing a very good job of, to sort of not be scientists, but understand what science is. And I think that science can play an important role in education. I mean, that's one of the places where I feel like science can not only inform medicine and whatever, but we should be really having an impact on what's going on in the schools and how children are being educated. And I think we do know things that can be brought into the school. So that's one way in which science can have an impact in society, or should. I don't know if it is. Should.
So just elaborate a little bit more on that paper from in which gestures help people learn. Just say a bit more about that, because it's really.
Well, we've done a number at this point. One way in which we did this was to literally teach children to make gestures that would instantiate the principle to solve the problem. So
you're using this Tower of Hanoi.
Tower of Hanoi was with adults.
This was with adults, right?
Yeah, this is the learning stuff is with children, although I'm trying to now do it with chemistry and organic chemistry in adults. And we're doing studies on that as well, where we're encouraging people to gesture. But I haven't
done
that.
So how does that go? How will it go?
Well, we have, so organic chemistry, one of the earliest things they teach you is about stereoisomers. And so we're asking people to think about that and to figure out what a stereoisomer is and then explain their answers. And when they explain their answers, they gesture like crazy. It's a very difficult mental rotation spatial task, so they gesture quite a lot. So the first thing we're trying to do is figure out whether the gestures that a novice learner is producing, again, reflects the edge of their knowledge. So can we predict who's going to profit from instruction just by looking at the gestures of this chemist novice? And we find that we are able to. We can predict who's going to profit from the instruction just as a function of looking at their gestures. So our next step now is to encourage them to gesture. And we're going to contrast it. You know, in chemistry, you have these molecules, these little models. So we're going to have people move the models, rotate them, and then think about them, as opposed to gesturing them. It looks the same in the way I've just done it, but gesturing about those movements, as opposed to just imagining the movements, and then see if that has an impact in the educational moment itself. I don't know what's going to happen, but I think it is important because people do use these models in classrooms, or don't, and they're not used as effectively as they could be. Now, one possibility is, you know, they're messy. You have to put the models in. If we could have the same effect by just gesturing, that could be very effective. So I think this is a place where we really want to see whether manipulating versus gesturing versus imagining have the same impact on learning. It's an open question. And it may differ for chemistry, for math, for, you know, Tower of Hanoi, for other kinds of problems. So that's one way in which we're playing with this.
One of the issues that I found in talking to people is quite often that students don't have much sense of the history or philosophy of science. They're just looking at the latest issue of the journal and the latest issue of the textbook. So I like to invoke this by asking people like you to think historically for a moment for me. And if I gave you a time travel token and said you could bring to your dinner table anybody with whom you could then have a conversation, ask questions, there's somebody that you're actually passionate about hearing about and having a conversation with?
That's an interesting question. Well, somebody for me would be Piaget, actually, because, you know, I was a little undergraduate, so certainly didn't have, I mean, took courses from him, but I never had a conversation with him.
Uh-huh.
So he would be somebody that, for me, would be fascinating. Now, not on my language part, because he doesn't, I don't think he thinks about language in the way that I would like him to think about language, but about other kinds of things. I think it would be fascinating to talk to Piaget and about his developmental ideas. You know.
What are you optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about? Well, I've been bringing all of this. I'm part of this Spatial Intelligence Learning Center, SILC.
Sure. One of the Temple, one of the
science Temple, Chicago, centers. Northwestern, right? And we've been really getting into educational issues. So one of the things is I really do believe that this working with gesture and hands can have an impact on education. And by working in this center, we're trying. So we've been interacting with Everyday Mathematics. That's a textbook, very widespread textbook in America. And we've been working with the creators of this textbook there at the University of Chicago about how to bring in these ideas. About how to use your body. I mean, how to use your body in a textbook. Well, everything's becoming electronic these days. And so I think this is the moment, if I really think about these movements and how these movements can change the way we think about learning, this is the opportunity to do so. So we're thinking about geometry. Geometry is an easy one to think about where gesture and nonverbal movements might play a role. So it's a small way in which we can impact education. But I think that the work that we're doing may really have an impact. That's a widespread impact if we can have an impact on a curriculum like that.
Do you have any thoughts about the digital culture and whether how it's changing the way in which we process information?
It is changing the way we process information. It's so interesting. It really is interesting. I don't know. I mean, who knows whether it's good or bad? It just is. And it's up to us to study it, you know, to really figure out the way in which it's changing things. I'm a real face-to-face person, so I don't like it when we only do typing, you know, when we go to email and we lose the face-to-faceness of conversation. I think we lose quite a lot. So that's one way in which things have changed. You know, but conversations that kids have with each other are over their phones more than their faces anymore. And so that's a place where things are changing. It'd be interesting to know what the impact of that is.
But are they still using gestures when they're doing that?
Interesting, yeah. Not when they're typing. Although somebody the other day told me they do gesture when they type. I thought, okay, maybe. But when they're talking on the phone, for sure, we do. I mean, gesturing's really tied to talking. When you're typing, I think it does diminish those. And certainly when I'm looking at you, if I'm not looking at you, I don't see them. So there are two functions that gesture has. One function is for me. They're the gestures that really have an impact on me. But my gestures also have an impact on you. So if I'm talking on the phone and I'm gesturing, that's helping me, but it's not doing anything for you, the listener. So I think the gesture can play both of those roles, the communicative role for you and then the cognitive role for me. These days we've been playing more with the cognitive role because I'm just intrigued by the idea that having moved my hands in a particular way, I'm changing the way I'm thinking. And so the next time I think, it's going to be different because I move my hands in these ways. So that's an intriguing idea for me.
A lot of this is to do with movement and timing as well. One of the other Science of Learning centers, of course, is the one at UCSD that I'm part of, this Temple Dynamics of Learning Center.
Yes.
And it does strike me as rather odd that when school budgets are cut, the first things to go are things like, you know, gym, PE,
right.
Or music.
Right, all of those things.
Which are
right.
All perfect for
Right,
improving hippocampus bodies. And all those sorts of things
right.
and so on.
I know, it does seem like it's not the right way to go.
Yeah. So, you could become quite an evangelist for this, couldn't you, in terms of making sure that the gestures stay, the movement stays in the curriculum?
But, I think it's an important part of the curriculum. First, I want to make sure that we're on the right track here, so I think we need to do more work. I don't think I want to be an evangelist. I think the thing I worry most about is actually putting the idea out and then having it be misused. In the same way that I think actually many of the ideas that Piaget had about learning were misused when they got into education. So I don't want that to happen, thinking that you have to move your hands. We might muck it up. In some ways it's working quite well, spontaneously. So I don't want to muck up something that's working well by having people pay too much attention to it. So I have to figure out what's important about it. But the other thing we have all of these iPads and whatever that we're doing. And there are movements that are made on those. Are those gestures? Well, they're getting close to gesture. So should they follow the format of gesture? Is it when I move a number from here to there, should I move it in the way that instantiates the idea? Or is it any movement is possible? Any movement is good. I think those kinds of questions are questions that relate to bodies, gestures. And it's becoming more and more relevant because the technology is changing.
Yeah.
So in some ways, gesture is being left out, and in other ways, it's being brought in a very important way, I think.
So what's the next stage? What are you hoping to come up next with? I mean,
we're exploring this role that I really feel like gesture can sort of bring you from action to abstraction. That's the way I've been thinking about it, because gesture is so tied to action. But it also can become very abstract, that maybe it could be a good tool from getting from sort of concrete thinking to more abstract thinking. So I'm thinking about that as a tool. That's one place I'm very excited about. And I'm also very excited about the Nicaraguan Sign Language Enterprise, to really begin to look at a language growing. We've got some of the pieces already, but we don't have all of the pieces. And we haven't really studied the same construction over these different phases. So with this team putting it together, I'm really excited about that. I think that could be really...
All right. I look forward to the next results.
Okay, good.
Susan Golden Meadow, thanks very much for talking.
Thank you.